welcome to Season 3, Episode 12 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we continue our conversation with Marcus Stipsilas, who joined me in studio in Berlin to share his experience of encountering truth in our relationships with people and God. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. This feels different because you are still sitting where you were last time we recorded, except that you're on the tablet again.
Yeah. Unfortunately, not in Berlin with you.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a strange feeling. I guess I look down a little bit more when you're on the tablet compared to when you're sitting in the chair, but it is funny because you're like in the same place. So, are you actually at home sitting in front of your sliding glass door there?
Yeah, that's why I'm not technically in the same place, because usually I'm doing this from the office. But I did run out to the office to grab the microphone. Nice. and then headed back, thinking it would be a little more low key here to be at home today. So
yeah, that makes sense, especially with all the construction they got going on there.
Yeah, that's it's gotten even louder. So
okay, now is the cat perch right behind you on the door?
No, the door, we don't have the cat. We had a cat thing on the window. Do you remember seeing that?
Yeah. That's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, no, we took it down actually. So it's not up anymore. I think they blew it out. Like they were on it so much that it eventually just wouldn't stick anymore. Yeah. And we had to take the cat perch out.
I was thinking if it's not there, it's not because it wasn't loved.
That's true. No, they loved it. Jill got that, I think, for a gift for the cats.
Nice.
And it was one of their favorites. One of the most utilized things we've ever got for them.
Yeah. Now, what are you drinking for coffee today?
Oh, today's special. A good friend of mine, I'll just name drop him here for a moment because I want to give him credit where credit's due. But my friend, Justin Vellner, who lives in Czech Republic, who we got to see right before we saw you guys in Berlin, he sent me home with a package of coffee beans.
Nice.
From his hometown, Milovica, which is just outside of Prague, about 40 minutes. And I just today opened these beans up and made some coffee with them, and they are fantastic.
Excellent.
So I'm drinking not drip coffee, a French press coffee, basically black, and it's wonderful.
Nice.
So I'm not sure whether the beans themselves are, well, I know where they say they're from Honduras, but the coffee shop at the train station, in Milovica that goes down to Prague is where he purchased them from. And we had some good coffee there. So this is very memorable. It's reminded me of the trip now. And it's reminded me also that I have an easy low light here, which is going to be that I'm no longer in Prague and in Berlin. So I'm previewing this. Sorry.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I also had a very nice French press, this morning, and it was the coffee that you had brought me from the UK. So yeah.
Gentlemen baristas.
Yeah. It was quite good. I made sure to go with the one that was regular and not the decaf.
I should have done it tonight.
I should have.
Yeah.
It's 7 p.m. What was I thinking? I totally forgot. Should have ground up the other one for now. Oh, well. Next time.
It's a bit bold for you to be drinking caffeinated coffee at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Oh, no. I'm not drinking anything right now. Oh,
it was earlier. It was earlier today.
Yeah.
You're right. It would have been perfect though. This would have been a perfect time to have a decaffeinated cup of coffee. So you could still be drinking coffee with me. You just wouldn't be getting the buzz you normally would.
Man. All right.
It's okay. Next time.
Something to look forward to. Yeah.
But you did like it. It was all right.
Yes, it was quite good. In fact, so Jenny puts cream and sugar in her coffee. And so she doesn't get the flavor profile as much, as drinking it straight. Yep. But even she noticed it this morning. She was like, hey, this is good coffee. So yeah. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Great. So what's a highlight been for you?
Well, every once in a while, you have to take pleasure in the little things in life. So my highlight for today is that we discovered a new Mexican restaurant. Ooh. Just 6 minutes drive away from us. And I tell you what, the tacos are incredible. Oh, they've got some like chicken tacos. They got this birria. Is that how you pronounce it? Do you know? It's like a beef, like a they basically do like a stew beef, but their fish tacos, which are walleye, were incredible. Oh, anyhow, we've gotten it twice now in the last 3 days. So that shows you how caught we are. And actually we'd looked at trying to, before we got it today, we already ate it for lunch today. Yesterday we were looking at getting it, but then we realized they're closed on Mondays. So, it's good. La Bodega, it's called. And nice. Man, I tell you, if you take joys in the small things in life, finding a new restaurant. I do remember once, maybe I've already said this on the podcast, so I apologize to any listeners who may feel like what I'm about to say is deja vu, but I do remember when I was teaching seventh graders or eighth graders, it might have been at church when we were doing Sunday school. A couple of the kids were bumming out because some things were going on in their life. And I said, you guys, just sometimes you got to drink the good coffee, which means treat yourself, you know, treat yourself. It's so funny. I ran into this kid in that group 6, 7, 8 years later. And he's like, I'll never forget. Drink the good coffee. He's like, I still do it. He's like, if I'm having a bad day, he's like, sometimes you just got to treat yourself.
Drink the good coffee. Yeah.
Just treat yourself, which doesn't necessarily have to be coffee, but it could be tacos. It could be just taking pleasure in something small in life that can brighten your day when things aren't going well.
I have not yet found a Mexican restaurant here that I feel good about. We haven't done a ton of looking for a Mexican restaurant. There's a Mexican grocery store, not terrible far away. And so we go shopping there every now and then and make our own stuff. But yeah, that's one thing that's a whole set of flavors that I have not yet really found here, and I miss it. Yeah.
That's a bummer, but I tell you what, every now and then I would trade this wonderful Mexican food that we have here for some of the Turkish doner kebabs that you get in town. So we don't get those here. Like you can't find them here. Yeah. They're not even like in existence in Minnesota other than a couple spots that have like kind of variations of it. But
Right.
So it's what's a highlight for you?
Well, I think it all revolves around the language learning thing, which has kind of been a theme off and on this whole year. But so on Saturday, Jenny and I went for a long bike ride with our old language tutor. So he was our teacher for about 8 months. And then he said, hey, would you guys like to go on a bike ride sometime? And we're like, sure. And so, we went on this Fajad tour out into the countryside, saw some fawns, here, and just had a really pleasant time, mostly in German with him. And that was really nice. Yeah. And so along with that is that this week, this Saturday is when I'm taking my first big test for language learning. So it's my, and so there's this kind of encouraging feeling with that of like, okay, I could be done with this first step, which would feel really nice. Mm. But that also connects to my low light.
Well, what's your low? Can I quick comment quick? I can't remember the last time I took a test.
Well, I can, because I had to take a test as part of my PhD, which was a lot of, I had to take comprehensive exams and was like, I don't know, 6 hours of exams or something. It was definitely noticeable. So
what year was that again?
Just real quick. There's a lady that's outside who's looking through the window and saw me sitting here recording. She had this big, like shocked, happy expression. And then she's checking out the gallery next door. So this is a fun moment.
Nice.
Sorry. The year that I took the comprehensive exams had to be 2019. Yeah.
So it's been a few years.
It has been a few years. Yep. Yeah.
Well, I hope it goes well for you. So what's your low light?
So I'm taking this exam on on Saturday, and there's this thing in language learning where you have these up weeks and down weeks, and I am in one of these stages right now where my grammar is slowly getting better, which is good news, but it means my fluency currently is suffering a little bit, and so like my early progress in German was a lot of work on the fluency side and not a lot of work on the grammar side. And now I'm doing a lot of work on the grammar side, and my fluency side is a little bit, I don't know. I ended up hiring a tutor online to work through some stuff this week, 'cause I just was feeling like I've had a couple of times in the last 2 weeks where I'm just like, do I even know this language at all? And so, So on the one hand, I'm excited that I'm taking the test. And on the other hand, language learning is exhausting and often discouraging.
How much, Yeah. How much of your language learning is book work and how much of it is like talking with people?
So if I were going to pick, I would do almost all talking with people. But the problem with that, of course, is that, I mean, so it's really good to be talking with people, but there are certain grammatical structures that just are really, really hard to pick up on as an adult.
Yeah.
And so I think at least for me, I really do need some of the book work. My least favorite is doing workbook stuff. I just hate workbooks. Which is funny because Jenny loves workbooks. We actually did a whole series or a couple of episodes on the other podcast, on the Untervegs podcast about language learning recently. So maybe I'll link that in the show notes. So what's a low light for you?
Well, I did kind of already preview one of the low lights.
True, is that
I'm not with you anymore and with friends in Europe, which there's always a sense of when you take a vacation, that's of that kind that you get the sort of post-trip blues a little bit, where it's like, oh, you're just bummed that you're not in it anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But one other bummer, and this is very Minnesotan. I've done this several times in the podcast, so I'll just continue since it fits the bill of my own culture. Is that winter long?
Is it the weather?
It is the weather. It absolutely is the weather because you got it. All winter long, we complain about how cold it is until it hits 100 degrees, like June 14th. And it's like, oh man, this is nasty. And it's so funny because everyone thinks Minnesota cold. They don't think about the blazing heat in the summer that I can get.
It does have the extremes. Yeah.
So we're in one of those where it's going to be like 99 today.
Wow. Yeah. That's different from here. I was wearing a jacket even tonight. Yeah.
I was just saying something to Jill about how I love that kind of weather though. The weather like in Berlin when we were there, which was a little bit chilly, but kind of windy. And we experienced that when we were in Ireland last August. And it was August in Minnesota is some of the hottest time of year. Right. And we'd wear a coat in Ireland. And again, I'm like, I love this weather. Like, I've got a lot of Irish blood in my family. And I think that's where I probably sweat so bad because I'm like, I'm meant to be living in that weather, not this.
It's just deep down in you. It is.
Yeah. It's passed on generations and I can't change it. Well, what's an insight that you have?
So yeah, I'll see if I can pull this into a coherent thought. So one of the things that we're working on is starting to put together the development plan for interns while they're here. And part of what I'm working on with that is a certificate program that goes along with it. And I was working on this and trying to figure out how much curriculum design perspective to bring in from the higher ed side and how much to kind of let it be something organic from the community that we're trying to develop here with the values that we want to bring into this space and who we want to be as, you know, Envision Berlin. And I think there is this interesting tension but in applied education where I want to make sure that the learning has a good theoretical grounding and that the people who are learning encounter that grounding, right? Like they're not exactly students, they're participants, but I want to make sure they encounter that theoretical grounding. I don't want them to be disconnected from it. And at the same time, I don't want the theoretical grounding to become the point, right? I want this applied learning where they come out of the experience and they have been formed in character, right? And I don't know. It feels like a little bit of a sideways insight. I don't really know. I'm still trying to wrestle with what it looks like, but it's super, super interesting. Here's the insight. Okay. Is that I haven't done this before. I've done things very much like it, but I haven't actually done this before outside of the, you know, confines of higher education itself. And there are things that we'll try to do to tie it back to higher ed and things that we'll do to try to make it work with that. But yeah, realizing that something that feels very much like what I've done before is in fact new to me. Yeah. So it's interesting.
Well, sometimes the goals of higher ed seem a little different. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to give out degrees and you give out grades and you assess them on whether or not they've grasped the content. And that doesn't necessarily mean they have to do standard tests or anything like that. But at the end of the day, you're handing someone a degree to say they've completed a certain series of courses that constitute the program that qualify them for a certain type of job or a certain field of study. And you don't really have that pressure to have to be that narrow with the goals that you're meeting. But also some of the positive things that come from that are some of the organizational structures and some of the theoretical grounding and some of the being, you know, we don't want our students to leave with a college education and not have encountered some of the major theorists around certain perspectives and theories, where you don't quite feel that necessity. You have to do that with the group you're working with, but to be able to kind of borrow a little bit from some of that concept, probably helpful.
Yeah. And I think there is also, I feel like I'm trying to do something. I've seen, I don't know if you want to call them discipleship programs, other things where there was a theoretical grounding, but by the time it gets to the people who are doing the learning, it's like so disconnected that it would almost be difficult for them to follow up on it, you know? And I want something more closely connected, something that feels more academic, I guess, in a way than that, where you can say, well, where did this idea come from? I think that's important. But then at the same time, making sure it's actually applied into real life. And I'm just thinking too, this connects in a really interesting way to the conversation that we have today with Marcus about truth and the nature of truth. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah. And I think you have a unique opportunity because those are areas of your own skill set too. So then it's not every day that ministries will have people with PhDs and have, you know, experience teaching in college, the classrooms for as long as you did on their team. And so you bring something unique to the team with that, that might not be a strength of someone else on the team. But you also get an opportunity to do something that is sometimes a painful thing to try to implement in an academic environment where you get the real practical applied learning that is actually hard sometimes to do in a classroom.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I hope so. So you're going on this other podcast soon and you'll be talking about some of the same things that we were talking about on this podcast, but with a different group, namely biblical scholars. Right. And I'm curious, like, as you're getting ready to do that, how does that feel, I guess, to take your work, you know, in front of other people who maybe are coming from a different, or maybe from your own discipline? Like,
exciting, but always intimidating, because I think everybody kind of lives with a sense of imposter syndrome.
Right.
If you've even heard scholars who've been doing, you know, work for decades and who've been recognized in their field, getting those sentiments. So some of it is, you know, you want to be able to articulate properly in a way that's that makes sense, but also that shows that you're competent in the field. And there's some of that with our podcast, but the truth is, you and I have been doing this kind of thing for a while. We've even talked about each other's projects for just off air, off the record, even in ways that make it. And I think the purpose is a little different. We're there. I think I'm hoping to be able to articulate quite precisely some of the claims that I make in the book, where here some of it is boiling down, like trying to make sense of it for an audience that's not, you know, necessarily, you know, PhDs in the field. Not, I'm not saying that the other podcast's main audience is only people with PhDs in the field, but certainly like the other conversation audience in the
conversation. Is people who have thought deeply about some of the finer points, and the background and are familiar with the theorists that you're interacting with.
It's kind of like if I were given a whole class semester to do this project, you know, say, hey, I'm teaching a class on Ephesians and Empire, I wouldn't feel intimidated going to class. I mean, I'm like, I could probably wing every one and do it quite well. I felt that way a bit with our podcast, because it's our podcast. If I fumble over my words, if I go, nah, that wasn't right, we can we can stop, we can re-articulate, we can add it in another episode. This is going to be someone else's podcast, so I'm just going to be jumping on, we'll hit record. And if I miss something or misarticulate something, there ain't no going back and saying, oops. So it's kind of a little different. Like, it's like the same thing as being invited into another classroom. You know, you've got the limited time, you got to try to nail your ideas.
And you don't fairly have the quickly rapport. And
precisely. You don't have the rapport and you don't have the capacity to go back and fix anything if you mess it up.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I hope that goes really well. That's super interesting.
I'm really looking forward to it.
how kind of the same sort of exercise of talking about it in front of a microphone will feel very different because of the context. Find bonus content and more at patreon.com/profsinrooms. We'll be back in a moment with Marcus Stipsilas. Could you maybe explain this idea a little bit more about, because I think the first thing that you said in response to the question of what is truth, I think the first thing that I remember you saying just now was like that it's in relationship or that it's, can you tease that out a little more?
Right. So I think because of the context that I grew up in and acknowledging that not all Malaysians grew up in the same exact context that I did, because my parents are in ministry, my family, I grew up after my parents started ministry. I know some pastors' kids came along and then their parents joined ministry. And also my parents being of an interracial marriage, kind of forging their own way of what culture would look like in a climate that at that time didn't celebrate unions that weren't of the same race or caste or ethnicities. It still has problems in Asia and all across the world, right? Like when we see people who are biracial and hear their stories. So growing up, it was very unique to be third culture and then to receive what seemed like very fundamentalist. At that time, I didn't know that, but very fundamentalist Christian teaching, because we grew up quite charismatic, Pentecostal, fundamentalist Christian, I would say, evangelical, all those kind of weird mix and match from stuff that made things work for our faith. And then, you know, growing up in a home that also emphasized collective thinking, never making choices just for ourselves, but how our choices impacted others and as a pastor's family impacted the congregation. So for instance, it wasn't true that we were poor. Like we were not below the poverty line when I came along. My parents had experienced poverty. So it wasn't true that we were poor, but we couldn't spend money beyond what was acceptable for a pastor's family, because that would then stumble others. So even though the fact that we could have afforded, I don't know, PSs 1, 2, or 3 when I was growing up, or a Game Boy, I never had the privilege of any of that, which I don't regret looking back. Maybe in those times I was sad about it, but I'm not mad about it now. But so that's kind of the thing about what was true, but kind of being relational, that truth of we were probably middle class, heading towards upper middle class, because my mom was a great saver, has always been a great saver, but we weren't living out that, you know, is that kind of making sense? Like that, I think that to me is an example of how truth is relational, because we cared about not stumbling the members within the church to think that, oh yeah, so the minute you have money, let's spend it kind of thing. Or at the same time, like we were living out of our means, which we never did as a family. So I think that's, yeah, maybe that's the, I don't know if that's a clear example, but that's the one I'm setting.
I'm really interested in thinking about this concept of truth as relational, because so many times when we talk about truth, we're mostly interested, who's the we we're talking about here, right? But a lot of folks, I would say, are interested in what truth tells or what truth says. So truth can be reduced maybe to like propositional content or like statements. Mm. But if truth is relational, I'm also interested, this is something I've been thinking about over the last couple of weeks, is what does truth do?
That's interesting.
Right.
So do you have any thoughts about that as thinking about the concept of truth as relational?
Right. Yeah.
Apart from what truth says and tells, what does truth do?
Yeah. So I think perhaps I'm not giving you giving you here, when you say we, who is we, right? And when I say you, who is you? I'm not giving you the Jesus is truth and truth is relational part, because to me, like that is sadly the point of reduction that we've come to, where it's become, yes, Jesus is truth, but also there are so many things about our world that is true. And then people will argue big T or small T, right? When I think about like relational truth, because relationship takes work, I think there's an imperative when it comes to truth being translated into action. Which I don't know if that statement answers your question, but that's kind of how I see it. Because if truth is relational and relationship requires work, interaction, active engagement, right? We don't just build relationships by being passive. Then truth must transform me, not just in my professions and declarations, but to the very core of who I am. And I believe I'm a relational being, not solely a relational being, but it is a huge part of who humans are created.
Let me try to push on this a little bit, because I think maybe I understand and maybe I don't. This will be a way to find out. So when you have a conflict with someone that you're in relationship with, sometimes it feels like there's a choice between being honest or speaking truth and preserving the relationship, and different people have different solutions to that tension. Yeah. How do you see those two coming together?
Right. Well, as an Asian person, I'll always choose to say face first.
and so the thing that is truer is the importance of the relationship rather than the truth of the offense, or how does that play out?
You know, I think to me, this might make sense. Truth as fact ceases to be relevant to me if truth as relationship is broken.
Mm-hmm. So if I have something true to say,
right,
but I've broken relationship with you, it doesn't matter.
There's no point for me. That's my perspective. Like, so you were right. Cool. Here's a cookie. Like, what do you want? You were true to who? True to yourself? True to the fact?
Really appreciate that. I remember I was sitting in an ethics class a long time ago here when I was a student at Crown, and our theology professor who was teaching ethics at the time had made a comment about, you know, honesty is always the best policy. Mm. And so I remember raising my hand. This was Dr. Husted. Did you have Dr. Husted?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, good. So you remember Dr. Husted. I remember saying to him, well, what do you do then if Mrs. Husted makes a pie and it's terrible? Do you tell her the truth? Mm. You know, are you honest? and he paused for a second, and in just great fashion, he says, sometimes honesty is stupid. And I think what he was getting at was kind of what you're indicating here, right? That there, if we had this policy that like truth is, you have to speak the truth and in right. brutal, blatant, like, what's the word I'm looking, not just honesty, but like,
savage,
without any discretion.
Yeah.
Like
young people just call
that we had to, what did you call it?
I said savage as the Gen X's will say this. I don't know.
Gen X.
Yeah.
Sorry, backwards. Gen Z's. Okay.
Well, this is particularly relevant, I think, for Christian people who sometimes feel this odd and awkward necessity to tell everybody what you think about everything. And maybe that's American cultural phenomenon. I don't know, but I feel like, and maybe it's that sort of fundamentalist bent that you mentioned, or evangelical bent. But I often think to myself, like, no, you don't have to always speak your mind. You don't have to. And to be honest, like to go in the direction of speaking the truth with this area, but at the cost of ruining the relationship, you're trading one truth for the other in some ways. Right. Mm. It shows in some ways that truth is complex, right. But that truth is effective, and that you need to weigh the effect, not in terms of whether, you know, you lie. It's right. not like, do I tell the truth or do I lie? But it's a matter of, there's every moment, I think, in a lot of relationships where there's just things that you keep to yourself.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking about the power of truth and what truth does. So on the one hand, sometimes truth can injure and truth can hurt, and that telling that truth isn't worth going there, right?
Well,
but then you always have to weigh the ethical point of like, go ahead.
Correct. Well, so you say truth can injure, which I don't think is, well, so injure how? Like I stab you and walk away? Or you have,
no,
you know, with burn victims, they have to clean the wound so it doesn't get infected, and it's incredibly painful, right? If we've ever had a burn or, you know, something. And it's painful, but it will ultimately be for healing. So I guess there's that separation too.
Yeah.
I'm not just stabbing people with truth and walking away.
I wonder, Justin, I'm thinking about Jesus, and I'm thinking about you as a New Testament scholar. And it seems like there were definitely opportunities where Jesus could have just spoken truth and instead did something different. And it wasn't dishonest, but it was a, and maybe what he was doing is communicating a relational truth that was more important than a fact or a propositional truth. Yeah. Does that seem right?
Yeah. So there's there's the stories where Jesus has opportunity to kind of just come down hard on somebody and he doesn't, and he shows mercy and he shows compassion. And I think that says a lot about his idea of truth. Now there's a danger in this, and that there's a lot of discussions right now in the moment that I've been hearing on Twitter and on social media about abuse in church contexts. Mm. And there've been lots of folks up in arms that when these abusive situations get exposed, it ruins the reputations of the pastors involved, et cetera. And I feel like what the reaction I'm hearing from some people on Twitter is that it doesn't matter whether that's true. You're ruining someone's reputation, And to me, I don't want to go in that direction. To me, that sometimes the truth brings things to light and it's deeply painful. And in that way, it could be injurious in this sense. You've got a relationship with a pastor that you look up to, that's a mentor. And then all of a sudden you find out that they have been concealing abuse in the church, right? And that's injurious to you now because the truth unveils and reveals that they're not the person you thought they were. Am I in favor of saying, well, look, that's going to hurt people's feelings, so just keep it to yourself? No. I'm not. So like, this is the interesting thing about truth. What does truth do? What does truth do? Sometimes when truth comes out, it can be painful. It can be confrontational. It can be, and then determining the times when it's appropriate to not tell Mrs. Houston that her pie isn't any good compared to when abuse needs to be, revealed, which I think is definitely the case, needs to be. They're two different situations, but it talks a lot about how truth isn't just what you tell. But to me, it seems like truth is also, it does various things. And I think there are a lot of folks on Twitter who want truth just to protect or truth to just uphold. But sometimes it doesn't do that, because sometimes when hard truths are spoken and they need to be spoken, it can actually unveil in a very painful way. I don't know. Is that off topic?
No.
I'm thinking of truth as relational in that sense, where it's so complicated. Yeah. And if as Christians, our policy is not, you just always got to speak the truth. Right.
I think the complicating factor to what you're saying, though, which is related to the discussion, but not to the topic of, maybe to the topic of truth, is what I have observed is even when some of these truths have come out, the people who the truths are exposing don't repent. Doesn't affect them to be true, and so then they become defensive or for a trauma response or something, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, but this is interesting, because I think again that something that maybe the post-colonial experience highlights for you is that when authority uses truth selectively,
right,
that then truth doesn't always affect authority in the way that it should.
Right.
There's a dynamic
there that's not equal. You're not starting with equal footings of, the most recent thing, right, that has come out is John MacArthur shaming someone from the pulpit for, he says that she is not willing to submit to discipline, which is that she won't receive her husband, who has been convicted and sentenced to prison for molesting children, that she wants to divorce him and take the children away from him, and she does not want to reconcile in the relationship. And so he sees his imperative as a biblical one. He needs to put her out of the community, excommunicate her, because to him, that is what God wants, right? And for me, when we just interact with truth as a principle, you get to the point where what was truth really about to begin with? Because that to me is, again, that reification thing of, you've given something that seems so inanimate a life of its own, and the people who are alive that it's supposed to govern are completely ruined by the process because you were trying to be truthful. And that comes back to, truthful to what? To what end? And that's why for me, the relationship part of truth is, I realize sometimes, yes, this might be true, but I'm not the best person to be truthful about it or to speak that truth. And I'll just give an example. In my course of interacting with friends, sometimes I will, in my amateur hour of reading psychology books or whatever, or Brené Brown mostly, let's just say reading Brené Brown, want to tell them like, hey, this is what's going on, but I'm not a psychologist. You know, I read the books and I try to apply it to my own life sometimes, but it's not my place. And I think part of the assumption about truth is that truth is objective and I am the best person to say this truth. And I'm not saying that be silent, but what I'm saying is maybe in humility, and that humility can only be realized in relationship too, but in humility to say this truth might be true. I'm not the one to walk it out with this person. And if I injure them with this truth and I'm not the one with the best resources to help them on this journey of pursuing truth, then what am I really doing? You know, I think most of the time, our attempts to be truthful is actually we want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel like we're in line with truth. And that in a relational point of view is selfish. That is self-centeredness. And that is the kind of truthfulness that I don't want to practice. It's not really truthful to me.
I wonder, do you remember times? I mean, so first, I think your example is really good and interesting of like this thing of I might know a thing, but I might not be the person to say it. And even the question of do I know it or how do I know it, which gets partly into those epistemological questions or maybe even spiritual development questions, you know, like is the Lord impressing this truth on me or not, right? I mean, there are different ways that we can know, which is a whole interesting question in and of itself. But I'm curious, when you think back to your time sitting in the classroom, taking classes at Crown, and you know, in college, there are often a lot of truth statements made and a lot of ways in which truth statements are defended, propositions of truth are you know, explained and defended. Were there ever times that you found yourself sitting there thinking, the way that this conversation is happening doesn't make sense to me?
Only like 98% of the time. Because I'd be like, so in apologetics class, they, you know, they'd have debates or whatnot. I'd be like, why? When didn't Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham debate and both just dug their heels in and nobody was the better for it? And why? And then I'm not saying that discourse shouldn't happen, but most discourse that happens outside of relationship just doesn't do anything. It's a waste of time. To me, like that's so definitely there were times when, you know, some statements were being made. I guess I didn't understand the motive because I didn't know the person. And if I don't know the person and I don't know their motive, then I find it hard to trust them, which, you know, then my trust isn't just built on truth. It's built on a relationship. So then I, you know, like Dr. Houston, I trust Dr. Houston. I trust him not because of the books that he's written, or the classes that he's taught over the years. I remember the thing that has stayed with me about my time in theology 1 and 2 and all the other contemporary theology classes that I took with him was when he prayed, I could tell that he knew Jesus and therefore I felt safe to learn from him. And he's not charismatic in terms of expression of faith in any way. At least he doesn't show that, or he never showed that in class, but he didn't have to, because when he prayed, I knew this is someone who knows who God is. And it was a deep kind of knowing. So I couldn't even explain like what made that truth to me. It was just a deep kind of knowing, and therefore I trusted him. But that trust didn't come with wholesale swallow everything that's being said, right? I still had to evaluate for myself, but it was a good starting place for me. So that made sense.
Which is really different than an approach to truth that says, here are 10 wrong ways of believing and let me deconstruct them for you. And then here's the right way because it's the only one left.
Right. Right. And why would you start there? Why not start with here's one way that has been done that has been good? I mean, of course, as professors in college, you want to offer a wide, I guess, not tell the student the answer. You wanted to do the work. But I wouldn't start with like, let me tell you why all the ways you're thinking is wrong. Like, that's just not a, I don't know. You don't do that, Justin, certainly. So I'm like, why would anyone start there?
Well, sometimes I do it as a devil's advocate and students think that I'm picking on them. And then I let them know, no, I think you're right on this. So don't back down when I challenge you a little bit. No. Yeah, no. Yeah. Don't let me push you around. I say that a lot. Don't let me push you around.
Yeah.
Cause they'll say a comment and I'll say, are you sure? And they'll say, I don't know.
Yeah. Right.
Cause I'll say, well, stick your guns here because actually I think you're right. And they'll be, what? Oh, I thought.
Yeah. Which makes it interesting.
I don't know. Maybe it's a bad
too.
Teaching technique, but I appreciate it myself. But
it makes it interesting because as the professor of the class, you like the dynamics of the classroom are you're expected to correct what is wrong.
Yeah.
So then when your intention is not to correct what is wrong, but to push for deeper thinking. That's not the immediate assumption of a student entering into a class that today the professor is going to help me think, although it should be. It's more like today the professor is going to give me a piece of information that I will use on the test so that I can pass this class.
Which is definitely not. Yeah. I mean, when I think about what I hope.
Way less Jones even than me, because I'm not sure you don't. When's the last time you gave a test, Jones? I mean, you've been off the circuit now for a year and a half.
We'll just say,
we call it the circuit.
I use.
It's like we're NASCAR or something. You've been off the circuit for a while, but even when you were on the circuit teaching, I don't think I remember you giving many tests.
I used them very selectively. We can say that.
I remember Jones's tests. Sometimes you didn't even know you're being tested and then you just half the class fails.
Wow. That sounds rough.
But it was fun. That's how I remember about your classes, where they were fun.
I think my goal, like in retrospect, and maybe being out of it for almost a year now, looking back at what I was trying to do, I think I usually was trying to connect students to the narrative that they were part of and to understand where they fit in relation to that narrative, which is not something that I can solve for them, right? It's more of saying, okay, here are the stories that are going on in the world and here's how you might relate to them. And here are how people feel about being part of the story in those ways, which is way less about propositional truth. Which is part of why I really pushed against tests is, you know, I mean, probably my favorite example of that is for me, somebody who comes out of the world religions class, which had a couple of different forms, but at the end was called Encountering World Religions. I didn't use a standard test in that class because I was afraid that students would do well on the test and come away with the mistaken idea that they understood other religions, which would be relationally false and also narratively inaccurate. And so
propositionally.
Yeah. I mean, and they would have some propositional truth, right? They would have some factoids, you know, that they had done well on. That's how I was taught world religions. And I think in some ways doing well on a survey of world religions course, you know, final exam can lead to a false interpretation of truth, right? Where it's like, okay, I know these things and I know that I know them because I did well on the test, but it lacks entirely the thing that you were talking about, Marcus, which is this relational reality. If you don't have the ability to relate with somebody from another religion and you don't understand how they understand those facts or whether they even think that what you think of as facts about the religion, like they may be completely irrelevant to somebody actually from another faith. Like sometimes those facts, even if they in some circumstances are factually true, they become false.
Right.
And so it's the wrong approach to truth. And so, I don't know. I think that this is where, and you said earlier, it's not that you don't think there is objective truth, but that how we interact with or approach with it or approach the idea of truth sometimes is too narrow or disconnected or
we're just realizing that we're interacting with truth. it's falsely attributed to Buddha, but there's this saying that the foot feels the foot when the foot touches the ground. Like we think we're interacting with the ground, but actually you're interacting with the sensation of what it feels like to touch mm-hmm. the ground. So we haven't actually interacted with the ground. And I think that's the reductionist part that takes over, because it's easy to understand. This is what's true about Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism or post-Christian Europe. Mm-hmm. And then there's no real, like,
I mean, that's fascinating too, interacting, you know, living in Europe now and thinking about things that I've heard American Christians say about secular Europe or whatever, mm-hmm. that we're so disconnected from the actual reality of people.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like there's this pressure though in Christian higher ed and even in church contexts to feel like if we're not telling people what is true and convincing them of it and filling their brains with true information, then they're going to leave our institutions or leave, you know, church on Sunday morning and wander aimlessly in the world. Or when they encounter difficult situations, they won't have the answer. And so there's this pressure almost to be like, well, you have to give tests, Jones, right? Because if you don't, then they might think that, you know, that these things are true when they're not, or you might think that these things are false when they're true. And so you kind of get, I mean, don't you get that sentiment sometimes from Christian higher ed and from even in church context that like the goal is actually to sort of, I mean, when we're doing it poorly, it's to brainwash people into the truth. And when we're doing it well, apparently it's to convince and to, I still find that to be problematic, even though I'm very sympathetic to the learning styles of like lecturing and presenting people with ideas and letting them wrestle with them. But I do feel like there's this pressure in those contexts to give the information.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I wish I had this statistic. I don't know that I do, but I think the anecdotes of people who did well on tests at Christian colleges and then went out into the world and found that they didn't know how to integrate their faith into what they found outside of the Christian college suggests that perhaps doing well on tests is not a good indicator of someone's relationship with truth.
Mm-hmm. I might add, I think maybe if we were somehow able to pull people who will say that they once identified as Christian, but now no longer identify as Christian, I'm not sure that people who have, you know, so-called left their faith fit along that fine line of all other people who never did well on exams, on theology exams. You know what I mean? So the question of how do we encourage people to live lifelong life of faith in the midst of all the trials and issues that come up in the world that we live in isn't as simple as saying, fill them with the right information.
Yeah.
It also doesn't mean that we are fearful of speaking the truth in the necessary situations. But it seems like the interaction is far more complex with truth and requires something more than just giving people the answers. Mm. I even found in my own life, there were times where I knew, like, this is an interesting thing. There are times when I knew the truth about God, we'll say. I mean, the things that I would check off on a theology exam and probably get right on a theology test. But the problem was, is that I knew them to be true, but I didn't find myself fully convinced by them in that I didn't experience those things relationally with God. And what I mean by that is that, sure, God isn't out to get me. Maybe that would be, so true or false, God is out to get you, right? I would say false, right? No, theologically, that's incorrect. But I felt that in my life. A lot of times throughout my 20s and even into my 30s, where even though I didn't think it was true cognitively, I felt it was true. Yeah. So that's the other interesting thing about truth is that cognition is like only one aspect, it seems, of truth and that affective thing. And it's not just a matter of saying, well, because what was in your head didn't get to your heart. Well, it could be that. But it also says something about the way within which my life experience has shaped me to where the affective thing was so much more powerful in my life than just the sheer cognitive answer. But I don't know. I felt like it's an important realization. It's that relational aspect of truth as well. That wasn't just like, oh, I needed to grasp the cognitive thing in my heart. It was that the cognitive thing didn't really give, it didn't provide. I don't know. It wasn't relational. Maybe that was it. I don't know.
This brings part two of our conversation with Marcus to a close. Join us next time for the third episode in the discussion about relational truth. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsandrooms for more conversation and bonus content. I hope you can join us for coffee again next time.
As well, bro. Have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right.
Bye-bye.